Chapter 9, The Pattern of Buddhist Life and Work. The subject of this chapter is the five spiritual faculties. The chapter title is intended to emphasize the overall purpose of these faculties, which is the living of a Buddhist life. Buddhism is concerned with life. One might even say that Buddhism is itself life, life in the sense of growth, in the sense of realizing the potential of one's life. A Buddhist is someone who is first and last alive, awake to life. We often come across people who, while they may be present in body, do not seem to be really mentally or emotionally present. They're not fully alive to what's going on, not really alive to other people, not alive even to themselves. But the most basic characteristic of a Buddhist should be that they positively vibrate with presence, with spiritual life, with a wakefulness to life. Everything else on the spiritual path is secondary to this and follows from it. I may say that this is one of the reasons why, when I was in India, I was so much attracted to the movement of conversion to Buddhism among the ex-untouchables and why I became so deeply involved in it. They were very poor and largely illiterate, indeed many of them still are, but one thing at least they had and still have, and that is life. They are completely alive. Their involvement with Buddhism means a sort of enhancement, a refinement of that life which they do already have. Travelling to an Indian village usually involves a journey by train, followed by a ride on a bus or a bullock cart, and then you finally approach your destination on foot. It's a laborious business as a rule, but if you've been invited to speak to the people of the village about the Dharma, then they certainly do everything they can to make the engagement a memorable and joyful one. You are often still a couple of miles out from the village when you are met by an enthusiastic party of 20, 30, perhaps 40 men, young and old, who proceed to dance you into the village, such being their traditional mode of welcome for an honoured guest. A long brass trumpet is sounded, and there's much banging of tambourines and rattling of castanets, and they dance and stamp energetically all the way to the village. There, some of the houses will be decorated in various ways, for example with chalk designs in front of the doors, and flags will be hung everywhere, especially the five-coloured Buddhist flag. And when they finally come together for the meeting, usually very late at night, everyone is agog to hear something about Buddhism. In short, everyone is alive to the occasion. In the West, we do things differently. We tend to lead rather separate, routine-filled lives. We are dominated, gripped by routines and responsibilities. And in such circumstances, how is it possible to be spontaneous, to bubble with spiritual life? Routine, by which I don't mean a carefully thought-out, balanced programme of activities, but a dull, mechanical daily round, kills spontaneity. And without spontaneity, there's no life in any meaningful sense. You might even go so far as to say that life is spontaneity, that spontaneity is life. This is why I'm here characterizing the traditional Buddhist teaching of the five spiritual faculties as the pattern of Buddhist life and work. The five spiritual faculties should amount in the end to a spontaneous and enthusiastic engagement with life and the work of life, in the fullest and deepest possible sense. What then are these faculties? In Sanskrit and Pali they are called indriyas, and if we look at the etymology of this term, we will find that it throws a great deal of light on the subject. Indriya denotes that which belongs to Indra. Indra being, in Indian mythology, the ruler of the gods. So the indriyas are those things that pertain to Indra, the ruler, and thus the word translates as the governing or controlling principles. What is really interesting about this word, however, is its application to what we call the senses. In the Indo-Aryan languages, indriyas is the term given to the five senses, or six if you include the mind. They are given this name, meaning governing, controlling, dominating principles, because the whole of human life as we normally live it is governed, controlled, dominated by these senses. Every living thing, whether vegetable or animal or human, belongs to a certain level of development. Every living thing, from the lowest to the highest, from the humblest to the most exalted, has its own place in the scale of evolution. And every sentient being is organized to function on its own particular level, which it does through the operation of its own particular range of senses, the indriyas. This is quite a sobering thought, really. Most of the time we are controlled, dominated, governed completely by our senses, though these do include, according to the usual Buddhist way of reckoning them, the mind as a sense faculty. We can see that this is the case most clearly, perhaps, first thing in the morning. During sleep, the senses have been more or less in abeyance. But eventually we wake up, we open our eyes, sleepily turn over, and start becoming aware of the external world. As we do so, the senses all begin to look for their respective objects, and we start to act on the impulses to which they give rise. We make tea, we switch on the radio, we look for the newspaper, we decide to have another 5 minutes in the warmth of the bed. The senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind are all moving out towards and engaging with various objects, including mind objects. And this goes on all through the day. All the time we are being pulled by the senses, and therefore we identify ourselves with the senses and with the psychophysical organism to which they belong. And we function most of the time largely on that basic psychophysical plane of the indriyas. However, this word indriyas denotes also the five spiritual faculties. Edward Conser calls them the five cardinal virtues, but this translation fails to register the fact that it is the same word as for the sense faculties. The fact that the same word is used for both sets of faculties is significant because it indicates the overriding importance of the five spiritual faculties to the spiritual life. The suggestion is that the two sets of indriyas perform an analogous function. Just as the five sense faculties govern and control and dominate mundane life, so in the same way, the five spiritual senses govern and control and dominate spiritual life. Just as we find our way about the physical world with our sense faculties, so in the same way we find our way about the spiritual world with the five spiritual faculties. If our various senses are, to the extent that we have them at all, more or less fully functioning, our spiritual faculties are embryonic and in need of development. It is the development of these five spiritual senses, or faculties, that makes up the pattern of Buddhist life. They are Shraddha, or faith, Prajna, or wisdom, Virya, or energy, vigour, Samadhi, or concentration, and Smriti, or mindfulness. Let us take them one by one. Faith. I have known people who have been surprised to find that there is any such thing as faith in Buddhism. They have come into contact with Buddhism under the initial impression that it is essentially rational, that emotion is not really involved at all. This confusion arises out of two mistaken ideas, that emotion is essentially irrational, and that faith is the same thing as belief. Belief, in the sense of accepting as true, on authority, something that one can never verify, or something that is even inherently absurd, is not faith, at least not in Buddhism. In Buddhism, as we have already seen in connection with the spiral path, Shraddha, or faith, covers the entire devotional or feeling aspect of spiritual life. Faith in Buddhism could never be said to be contrary to reason, or even beyond reason. Faith is the emotional counterpart of reason. What you understand with your intelligence, you must also feel with your emotions. The two go together, and you can't really separate them. Shraddha in Buddhism is faith in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But it is especially faith directed towards the Buddha himself, because, at least from our point of view, the Buddha comes first. Even though the Dharma represents immemorial truth, we would know nothing of it without the Buddha, and there would certainly be no Sangha without him. In Buddhism, faith is essentially faith in the founder of Buddhism himself. However, it's not just belief, it's not even just feeling. Faith in the Buddha is the sort of emotional response that you have when you're confronted by the embodiment of enlightenment. This confrontation can take place in various ways. You can, of course, be confronted personally by some living being who is the embodiment of enlightenment. Alternatively, you can be confronted through literature, by reading about someone who was such an embodiment. If not the life of the Buddha himself, then perhaps the biography of the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa, or that of Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch of Chan or Zen Buddhism. With any of the great masters or teachers, there is the possibility of an immediate emotional response to accounts of their lives, whether historical or legendary, a response that is not just sentimental, but engaged, challenging, personal, real. Then again, you can be confronted by an image, an artistic representation, a painting or a statue of someone who was enlightened. And here I'm reminded of a French Buddhist nun whom I knew in Kalimpong in the 1950s. She told me that in her student days in Paris, she used to like visiting museums and art galleries, which is how she found herself eventually in the Guimet Museum of Oriental Art. She was a rather militant, aggressive woman. She told me that she used to go around with a pair of ice skates with which to defend herself if she was attacked. "Well, I thought if I carried these skates with me, if anyone tried to attack me, I'd slash the blades across his face." But as she strode along the galleries of the Guimet, having left the skates in the cloakroom, looking to left and right rather fiercely as she usually did, suddenly she encountered an image of the Buddha. From her description, I gather that it was an image from ancient Cambodia. She just turned a corner, and there was the celebrated smile, faint and delicate and rather withdrawn, so characteristic of this Khmer style of sculpture. The whole expression of the face is intensely peaceful. This image, the face of this image, just stopped her in her tracks. She told me that she stood looking at it without moving, almost without blinking, for 45 minutes. She couldn't take her eyes off it. The impression of peace, tranquility, and wisdom that emanated, that streamed, as it were, from those features, was so strong that she couldn't pull herself away. She hadn't yet studied anything about Buddhism, but as soon as she saw this image, she felt compelled to ask, what is it that gives its expression to this image? What is it trying to tell me? What depths of experience does it come from? What could the sculptor have experienced to be able to express something like this? Confronted by this embodiment of enlightenment, she could not move away unchanged. In fact, it determined the whole subsequent course of her life. This is the kind of emotional response we can have to an embodiment of enlightenment simply rendered in stone, let alone one in the form of a living person. And it is a response that amounts to faith. What it is, in fact, is the response of our potential enlightenment, our own deeply hidden capacity for enlightenment, to the actual enlightenment with which we find ourselves confronted. There's something deep down within us that has a sort of affinity with what is fully realized, fully expressed, fully achieved in that embodiment of enlightenment. There's a sort of kinship. It's as though you have two stringed instruments side by side. If you sound the strings of one, the other starts softly vibrating too. And what this response gives rise to is devotion. There are all sorts of different ways of expressing devotion, but traditionally it is done by means of prostration or worship, the offering of flowers, the lighting of candles and incense, and so on. Some people in the West are a little shy of Buddhist devotional practices. They would like to think that Buddhism had no truck with the kind of apparently superstitious activities that they were trying to get away from when they abandoned Christianity. They feel perhaps that these are practices for children, and that it is time to be grown up and stop bowing and scraping and offering candles and the like. However, if you leave out devotion, you are closing the door on any emotional engagement with your spiritual ideal. A healthy spiritual life, just as much as a healthy psychological life, must include the expression of emotion. Having said that, there is a balance to be maintained. Faith and devotion can go to extremes, and when they do so, they become superstition, fanaticism, or intolerance. It is for this reason that according to this teaching of the five spiritual faculties, faith, the whole emotional and devotional side of the spiritual life, should be balanced by wisdom. Wisdom. Broadly speaking, in Buddhism, prajna, wisdom or knowledge, is conterminous with the Dharma understood as truth, principle, reality. More specifically, it consists in seeing things as they really are, rather than as they appear to be. It consists in seeing all worldly existence as conditioned, and thus as unsatisfactory, impermanent, and without an ultimate and unchanging self. At the same time, it involves seeing the unconditioned, by contrast, as being blissful, permanent, and characterized by true individuality, unimpeded by the illusion of a separate and substantial self. Wisdom is further seen in the Mahayana development of Buddhism as consisting in the realization of the great shunyata, or voidness, that is, the essential non-difference between the conditioned and the unconditioned. Technically speaking, wisdom is of three kinds. Firstly, there is shrutamayi prajna, wisdom or knowledge or understanding that is derived from hearing or reading. You are sufficiently interested to take the trouble to listen to someone speak about the Dharma, or to pick up a book and read about it, and you are receptive enough to derive some understanding from what you hear or read. It makes sense to you and you take it in. Secondly, there is chintamayi prajna, prajna or wisdom based on thinking, i.e. your own individual thinking. You start reflecting on the Dharma, chewing it over rather than just swallowing it undigested. You start thinking on your own account, seeking to arrive at an understanding based on your own thinking, working out the implications of the Dharma yourself, rather than having it interpreted for you by someone else. Thirdly, bhavana mayi pranya. Bhavana means calling into being or cultivating, and it is conventionally translated as meditation. So this is wisdom based on one's reflections in the context of the experience of higher states of consciousness. It is not arrived at through intellectual excogitation. It is realized, intuited, seen as a result of meditation, as a result of one's own spiritual and especially transcendental experience. Most of us have had some experience of all three kinds of wisdom. We have all come to some understanding as a result of hearing about the Dharma, or at least reading about it. We have all developed our understanding as a result of independent thought, however rudimentary. And many of us have had moments of direct vision, some glimpses of the truth as mediated by a higher state of consciousness, especially in meditation. But it is important to be clear about which category of wisdom our experience falls into, and especially about whether it is our own wisdom or actually someone else's. It's easy to imagine that we have reflected upon something ourselves, when all we have done is juggle with someone else's thoughts and insights. A useful and illuminating exercise is to survey one's ideas and views and perceptions and assess how many of them can be found to be the result of one's own individual reflections. Unless one is a very exceptional individual, it won't be many. Nearly everything we know comes by hearing or reading, so 99% of our knowledge and understanding we get at second hand. Nearly all of us tend to consume large daily quantities of facts and opinions, without giving much time to really thinking about them. Unless we earn a living by thinking, we probably feel we can't afford the time simply to sit and reflect upon things in such a way as actually to come up with a truly original thought. Can one honestly say that one has ever had a truly independent thought? Has one ever really thought something out for oneself from beginning to end, without any help at all? Has one ever thought something through and come up with an original idea? Has one ever had a significant thought, even a shade of a variation of one, that no one else has ever had? It happens, of course, but chintamayi pranya is quite rare. As for bhavanamayi pranya, that is even more rare. We may imagine that we've had a direct intuitive insight into something when all we have done is achieve a certain depth of reflection that has given us a clearer idea of it. The wisdom that almost any of us is likely to have garnered while in higher meditative states is infinitesimal. All of which may sound unnecessarily discouraging, but it is, in fact, the reverse. If we never make these distinctions, we may flatter ourselves that the ideas and insights we embrace are our own thoughts, even our own experience. But by doing so, we will not be allowing ourselves the option of actually moving on to a deeper and more personal investigation of reality, and even perhaps eventually the possibility of an actual experience of the truth, a truly transformative wisdom. Pranya represents the whole intellectual and doctrinal side of Buddhism. At least the first and second levels or kinds of wisdom do. The third, strictly speaking, is neither intellectual in a narrow sense, nor emotional either, but represents a sort of fusion of the two. But the first two definitely represent an intellectual, as opposed to an emotional or devotional, approach to the goal of Buddhism. The development of prajna can therefore, when taken to extremes, become a merely academic sort of knowledge. It can become, as a friend of mine once described the writings of a famous scholar of Buddhism, as dry as the last ounce of dust in desiccation. Unfortunately, some people have a definite taste for this sort of thing. Another old friend, Lama Govinda, who originally came from Germany, said of his own countrymen that their idea of a good lecture on Buddhism would be a discussion of all the different possible meanings of a certain term according to various dictionary definitions, and follow this with a close analysis of its meaning according to at least a dozen Buddhist scholars, before concluding judiciously that all these views were wrong. This, he said, was the way to fascinate a German audience. And he said that the English liked a different sort of lecture. What they wanted was the complete picture, a single perspective on the whole subject. Whether this would still be the case today is another matter, but it does illustrate the way a strength, in this case the German tradition of intellectual rigour, can become a weakness when it is not balanced by anything else. For this reason, in the five spiritual faculties, faith and wisdom form a pair. The one must be balanced by the other. Neither must be allowed to preponderate over the other. They must work together in harmony. Vigour. As we saw when we considered virya as one of the seven factors of enlightenment, it is defined by Shantideva in the Bodhicharya Avatara, the guide to the career of the Bodhisattva, as energy in pursuit of the good. Energy in the usual sense of the word, as applied to people who dance all night or pursue money and power vigorously, is not virya at all. Virya is energy applied to the goal of nirvana. Virya can be of two kinds, objective and subjective. The objective aspect of virya consists in doing things to help others, things that may involve a certain amount of physical effort and trouble, even difficulty. In its subjective sense, that is, as applied to one's own mental content, it corresponds to samyak vyayama, right effort or perfect effort, the sixth step of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right effort consists of the four great efforts. Firstly, the effort to eradicate unskillful states of mind. Secondly, to prevent the arising of unskillful states that have not yet arisen. Thirdly, to maintain skillful states of mind that are already present. And fourthly, to bring forth skillful states that have yet to arise. This is the fourfold right effort. It is the effort to eliminate all unskillful states of mind, all states that are rooted in greed and hatred and bewilderment or delusion, and to cultivate all skillful states, all states rooted in generosity, love, and wisdom. Both these aspects of virya, objective and subjective, need to be cultivated, as the Buddha himself never tired of pointing out. His discourses quite often get onto this subject of the importance of maintaining the momentum of one's practice. One presumes that he must have noticed his own followers tending to let things slide from time to time, to stop putting in the effort, to stagnate. There is quite an arresting story from the Jataka tales that would evidently have been recounted in order to awaken energy that was beginning to flag in this way. The Jataka tales are a collection of stories about the virtuous activities of the Buddha-to-be in his previous lives, both human and animal. They're a kind of Buddhist folklore. This story concerns the god Indra, who happens to be on a journey when he comes to the banks of a river so broad that he can hardly see the further shore. Just down by the edge of the water he finds a squirrel that is behaving in a rather extraordinary manner. It is repeatedly dipping its big bushy tail into the water and then lifting it up and sprinkling the water on the dry land. Seeing this, the king of the gods is intrigued and says to the squirrel, "What on earth are you doing?" The squirrel replies quite cheerfully, "I'm emptying all the water of the river onto the dry land." Indra, of course, is totally bemused at the scale of this ambition. "You foolish creature, do you really think you can fulfill such a task?" But the squirrel looks at him unabashed. "Certainly. It's only a question of going on long enough." Indra is quite impressed by that, and the Buddha comments that, yes, there may appear to be little progress taking place. We may not seem to be getting very far, but if we carry on long enough, anything may be achieved. If we keep putting one brick on top of another, a house may be built. If we keep reading one page after another, a particular subject will eventually be mastered. If we keep doing a regular meditation practice day after day, our overall mental state will change. Indeed, it is the only way these things can be done, by steady persistence. From moment to moment, even from day to day, we may seem to be progressing by such infinitesimal amounts that it can all seem to be a waste of time. But in the spiritual life, that is how we achieve anything, by regular, sustained, long-term effort. However, there is no doubt that, like the other faculties, true vigour can turn into something much less helpful. It can become restlessness, energy in pursuit not of the good, but of anything that will take us away from our experience of ourselves, anything that will distract us from our deeper task. If we can't settle down, if we're always wanting to be on the move, on the go, busy doing something, anything, then this is not vigour, but a neurotic inability to sit still, a neurotic compulsion to avoid any kind of relaxed attentiveness to what is present before us. The result is activity that tends to be restless, agitated and jerky, whereas real vigour is relaxed, easy and smooth. Real vigour is achieved by not allowing one's energy to be one-sided. In short, by counterbalancing it with the spiritual faculty of samadhi. One-pointedness of mind. As we have seen, samadhi covers the whole field of what we generally call concentration and meditation. Samadhi literally means the fixation of the mind on a single object. In other words, one-pointedness of mind. However, there's nothing forced about this concentration. It is more accurately described as a unification of the total energies of the psyche. Our energies are generally quite scattered. It is rarely that we are at once mentally, emotionally, and physically fully concentrated. Samadhi consists in drawing all of ourself together into a single focus of energy. The Buddhist scriptures describe samadhi in terms of the four dhyanas. These represent progressively purer and clearer states of superconsciousness, which are retained as one's energies progressively become more and more unified. They are usually described, especially by scholars, in a rather dry, analytical manner. All one gets very often is a catalogue of different mental functions. But this is unfortunate, because it does need to be emphasized that these are actual experiences attainable by living human beings like you and me. And in fact, the spirit, the actual human experience of these higher or more unified states of consciousness, is brought out very well by the Buddha himself in four famous similes. Of the first dhyana, the Buddha begins, "Suppose you take a plateful of soap powder." By the way, this soap would have come, this may come as a surprise, from a soap tree. The tree has a large fruit that would have been dried and powdered, as it still is in parts of southern India, and used as soap. And the Buddha goes on, suppose you then gradually mix your soap with water and knead it all together until you have a ball of soap absolutely saturated with water, so that there is not a single speck of soap powder that is still dry, and not a single drop of water trickling free of the ball. When you sustain this level of meditative concentration, you are saturated with this higher consciousness. A blissful peace fills every part of your psychophysical organism. You are permeated by that super subtle sense experience, just as the powder is permeated by the water. There is no unintegrated energy draining away or drifting off. Well, the Buddha says, the first stage of dhyana is like that. It is a state of unified consciousness, the union of positive and negative forces, the yin and the yang principles, as the Chinese tradition would say, within one's conscious mind. It is a state of harmony, integration, peace, in which the energies of the conscious and the energies of the unconscious mind are brought together, unified and harmonized, just like the soap powder and the water in the Buddha's simile. For the second dhyana, the Buddha proposes the image of a pool of water, perfectly clear, pure water, being constantly refreshed and replenished by a subaqueous spring. So the second dhyana is a clear, pure state of consciousness into which rapture and joy are bubbling up all the time from deep within you. As for the third dhyana, this is likened to lotus flowers immersed in a pond of fresh water. Their stalks, their leaves, flowers, blossoms, seed pods, everything lives immersed in the water, permeated by the water, but still separate and distinct from it. Similarly, we experience our consciousness as completely pervaded and fed by an all-encompassing bliss. Finally, the Buddha comes at the fourth level of higher consciousness through another typically Indian image. He invites you to imagine that in the heat of the day, when you are very hot and dusty, you go and bathe in a pool or a river. And then, on emerging from the clear, fresh water, you wrap yourself in a clean, cool, white sheet. And you just sit there like that, enveloped from head to toe. In the same way, in the fourth dhyana, you wrap yourself in a purified consciousness that insulates you from all harm. The dust of the world cannot touch you. Such are the Buddha's comparisons for the four successively purer and clearer states of samadhi. However, although these are intensely positive and beneficial attainments, they too can be taken to extremes if they're practiced on their own without reference to anything or anyone else, without being balanced by energy and vigour. What you can end up with is inertness or passivity, even laziness or drowsiness. You find this particularly in the case of people who sit naturally and comfortably in meditation posture and are happy to sit there, more or less undisturbed by gross mental activity, but not putting any effort into really deepening their awareness. So samadhi must be balanced by virya, especially work that benefits other people, and especially physical labour. In the Zen monasteries of Japan, as in the pre-communist Chan monasteries of China, you get your full share of both meditation and work. However many hours of meditation you do, you will be expected to do almost an equal number of hours of hard physical work. And this means down on your knees, floor scrubbing, or up to your elbows, pan scouring, rather than deliberating over the arrangement of a couple of flowers, or taking a delicate paintbrush to a porcelain bowl. A friend of mine, Peggy Kennett, who became a Zen teacher in Japan after many years of difficulties, being foreign and female, once wrote to me describing the daily program in her small monastery, where she had 3 or 4 disciples. They began at 4 in the morning with hard physical work until 9, and then had a simple meal, after which they got down to 4 or 5 hours meditation, and finally they had another light meal in the afternoon. That was their life, she said, physical labour and meditation. If they had been spending all their time in meditation, you can be quite sure, in the case of the comparative novices anyway, that they would have become just lazy. On the other hand, if they'd been spending all their time in physical labour, they would eventually have become, unless exceptionally gifted, more or less brutalised, just hewers of wood and drawers of water. So both must be there, at least to some extent. So much meditation, so much physical effort, a balance between the two. Most people are naturally inclined either towards activity or towards meditation, depending on their psychology, on whether they are extrovert or introvert. Some people have suggested that Buddhism is particularly suitable for introverts because of its emphasis on meditation. But this is to fail to take account of the balance of qualities called for by this teaching of the 5 spiritual faculties. Besides, once an individual has made some definite spiritual progress, they are beyond this sort of classification. You can say neither that they are introvert nor that they are extrovert. It is important to balance a natural introversion, which may express itself in an affinity for meditation, with outward-looking activity and healthy work, or vice versa, certainly in the earlier stages of one's spiritual career. Mindfulness. In the Buddhist tradition, as we have seen, mindfulness, or the development of awareness, is practiced with regard to 4 areas of experience. Firstly, as regards the body and its movements and attitudes, one is mindful of whether one is walking, standing, sitting, or lying down. One brings full awareness to the whole body, whether moving or still, and one is mindful of what each hand and foot and every other part of the body is doing. Secondly, one practices mindfulness as regards feelings, whether pleasant, painful, or neutral, whether one is happy or sad, elated or depressed, pleased or displeased. Thirdly, one tries to sustain mindfulness of thoughts, whether one is thinking about dinner or friends or relations or the work to be done the day after tomorrow. One should know exactly where the mind is going, where it is straying from minute to minute. The 4th area of one's experience of oneself to which mindfulness is applied is one's higher spiritual ideals. Whatever one may be doing, wherever one may be going, even in sleep, one keeps up at least a sort of undercurrent of awareness or mindfulness of one's ultimate goal. This is, of course, one of the purpose of mantras. Repeating a mantra to oneself throughout the day is a means of keeping in touch all the time with one's ideals. One may be out shopping, or sitting down with a cup of tea, or talking to someone. But if the mantra is always there in the background, one never completely loses touch with one's ultimate objective. So this is what the practice of mindfulness entails, maintaining some level of awareness of all these different areas, all the time. Nor is there any danger of getting caught up in an unbalanced over-enthusiasm for the practice of mindfulness. Unlike the other spiritual faculties, mindfulness or awareness does not need to be balanced by something else. If faith is not balanced by wisdom, it becomes blind and fanatical. If wisdom is not balanced by faith, it turns cold and dry as dust. If energy is not balanced by meditation, it degrades into mere restlessness. And if meditation is not balanced by vigour, it degenerates into sloth and apathy. But in the case of mindfulness and awareness, there is no such danger. By its very nature, It is incapable of degenerating when left to itself. It does not need to be balanced. In fact, mindfulness is itself the balancing agent. It is only through mindfulness that you can balance faith and wisdom, energy and meditative concentration. And mindfulness is so pivotal to Buddhism because balance itself is so pivotal to Buddhism. Indeed, the Buddhist spiritual life is the balanced life at the highest possible level, in the broadest possible sense. If we're not trying to be balanced, then we're not really practicing Buddhism. Being Buddhist really means always trying to avoid slipping into extremes, or rather rising above the tendency to slide to one extreme or the other. It means looking for a point of balance, the pivot or fulcrum, as it were, between or rather above the extremes. And we do this through the exercise of mindfulness. All this is not to say that mindfulness can be said ever to stand alone in any literal sense. In practice, you can't really have any one faculty without also having the others, even if in a lesser degree. They are all present. One of them may predominate, but the fact it is there at all means that the others are there, at least embryonically. And the spiritual effectiveness with which any faculty operates will depend on the degree to which it is balanced by the others. For instance, you may have a lot of devotional feelings. You may be fond of offering flowers, lighting candles and waving sticks of incense. But this will not constitute faith in any real sense without some understanding of the significance of it all. Thus, there is no faith, properly speaking, without wisdom, and vice versa. There is no faith without spiritual energy either, because when you participate in any devotional exercise, a certain amount of effort is involved. At least you have to turn up. The same goes too for concentration. Devotional practice and concentration go hand in hand. In the process of making offerings or chanting a mantra or reciting a puja or performing prostrations, you will, if you do these things with the appropriate faith and devotion, develop concentration, sometimes a deeper level of concentration than you might normally get even in meditation. And finally, of course, mindfulness must be there with faith, otherwise there can be no continuity to your faith, no possibility of sustaining it beyond a series of fitful impulses unconnected to one another and therefore going nowhere. So the pattern of the Buddhist life lies in the development of all the five spiritual faculties equally: faith and wisdom, energy and concentration, and above all, mindfulness. In this respect, it is interesting to compare these five spiritual faculties, or at least four of them, with the four principal yogas of Hinduism. The word yoga in Hindu systems of thought means union, that is, union with the higher self according to the Vedanta, or union with God according to the theistic forms of Hinduism. Thus, each of the four yogas is a particular path to union with the higher self or with God. At the same time, they correlate quite closely with four of the five spiritual faculties of Buddhism. Bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion, corresponds to the spiritual faculty of faith. Jnana yoga, the way to union through knowledge, is the Hindu equivalent of the spiritual faculty of wisdom. Karma yoga, the way of selfless work, matches up with the Buddhist faculty of spiritual vigour or energy. And Raja Yoga, union through the royal science of concentration and meditation, is of course the Hindu version of the spiritual faculty of meditative concentration. The correlation is quite exact. However, the significance of this comparison is to be found where the two systems part company, which is in the way they are applied.
A Hindu teacher will tell a disciple who is very emotional to take up bhakti yoga. That is, to leave aside jnana, karma and raja yoga and seek liberation simply through being a devotee. Someone who is very intellectual, on the other hand, will be told to follow just the path of jnana, the path of knowledge and study. Then again, a person who is very active will be advised to take up the spiritual path of unselfish work. In modern India, politicians are often accorded the courtesy title of karma yogins, because of course there is no one so unselfish, if we go by the tenor of their pronouncements, as a politician. They give up all their time, all their energy for the public good. Someone finally who is introspective and perhaps a bit uncommunicative, a loner, will be picked out as a natural Raja yogin and will be set to meditate and not bother with knowledge, devotion or outward activity. Thus the Hindu approach is to follow the line of least resistance. They say that if your natural bent is towards, say, devotion, then you should specialise in that. However, Buddhists take the opposite and more demanding approach. They say that one should pay attention to the faculty which is weak. If one's faith is strong, then one needs to cultivate wisdom, and vice versa. Otherwise, one's strength will become a weakness. If one is meditative, then one needs to get up and cultivate some outward going energy, and vice versa. Developing one's strong point fully will actually depend upon developing one's weak point. Indeed, all four faculties, faith, wisdom, energy, and meditation, need to be developed. Otherwise, one's spiritual development will be lopsided. The reason for this difference in approach may well lie in the one faculty that is missing from the Hindu system. It is quite astonishing to note that mindfulness is not stressed in Hinduism at all. But this is my own personal experience, having heard Hindu teachers and pandits speaking on hundreds of occasions. Amongst many addresses and discourses about devotion, spiritual knowledge, meditation, and so on, not once have I heard mindfulness or awareness mentioned. It just wasn't there. This may be one of the reasons why, in Hinduism, you have to choose between the four yogas. You can't unify them because they can be unified only through mindfulness or awareness. There was one great Hindu teacher, Sri Aurobindo, who did blend all the four classical yogas into what he called an integral yoga, but even he says nothing about mindfulness or awareness. Mindfulness does seem to be a distinctively Buddhist emphasis. The environment for Buddhist life and work, for the growth and development of the five spiritual faculties, is provided by the spiritual community, the Sangha in the broadest sense. It provides spiritual friends to help us identify where we need to put our energy, whether into meditation, beneficial work, devotion or study. As for mindfulness, this is to be practiced constantly as an aspect of everything we do. The Sangha also provides opportunities for us to help set up, support and make use of facilities by which the spiritual faculties may each be developed. Traditionally, these facilities would have centred around viharas, where the monks lived and practised and taught. But today in the West, they often consist of public centres, retreat centres, right livelihood businesses, libraries, and so on. Nurturing the five spiritual faculties. The spiritual community is, we may say, like a greenhouse. Seeds are sown in trays under glass during the cold weather, to be transplanted outside when they have germinated and the weather is a bit milder. Likewise, it is in the more favourable environment of the spiritual community that our spiritual faculties will best develop. Of course, the plants remain in the greenhouse only while they're comparatively vulnerable. And in a way, it is the same with us. The point of the spiritual community is not to provide a closed shelter from the world, but our spiritual faculties are always liable to be crushed or frozen or dried and withered or burnt up if we do not have the spiritual community, a favourable context for intensifying spiritual practice, to support us. This image of spiritual development as being like the growth of a plant is, of course, a very traditional one, going right back to the Buddha's vision of humanity as being like a bed of lotuses. It can be useful to think in terms of nurturing our spiritual faculties, helping them to grow and develop by making sure we have appropriate conditions. I would say that, just as there are five spiritual faculties, so there are also five conditions for spiritual growth, though this is a list of my own, not a traditional one. For the growth of a plant, obviously, five things are needed. First of all, there needs to be a seed, and then the seed needs soil, warmth, light, and water. Similarly, if we are to grow, if we are to develop our spiritual faculties, five things are necessary. First of all, the seed is the potentiality for enlightenment. And according to traditional Buddhist teaching, all human beings, even all living beings, do possess that. The seed is there. We can all become enlightened if we make sufficient effort. Of course, the effort involved is very great, and if conditions are propitious. Then, just as the plant needs soil, we need circumstances that are favourable to spiritual growth and development. We can still develop to some extent if circumstances are unfavourable, but it's much more difficult. In particular, we need leisure, health, and facilities of various kinds. And in the West, we're very fortunate that usually these facilities do lie ready to hand. Many Buddhists in India, for example, do not have access to the facilities that we enjoy. For them, it's not easy to follow the spiritual life for all sorts of reasons. I heard about a young woman who became a Buddhist and who wanted to take up meditation. But she came from a family who all lived together in a hut that had only one room, and there were 18 members of the family. But she was determined to meditate. So she meditated every morning. She got up very early, sitting on a shelf to one side of the hut, and in that way she kept up her meditation practice. Not many of us in the West ever have to meditate sitting on a shelf in a small room occupied by 17 other people, but this is what she did. I also heard of the case of an old woman who wanted to go on a week's retreat. The cost of a retreat in India is very small, but this old woman just didn't have that money. So what did she do? She worked for a month as a farm labourer, digging and carrying stones. This was at the age of 70, and she saved up her money, and then she went on a week's retreat. We don't have such difficulties anywhere in the West, certainly not outside some of the Eastern European countries, or perhaps some parts of South America. We have it very easy, and we don't always appreciate that. We have access to books, we have free time, we have health, we have leisure. So we have to ask ourselves, do we really make the best use of all these facilities? Then, corresponding to the warmth the seed needs, we need the warmth of spiritual friendship. This is very important in Buddhism. I usually distinguish between two kinds of spiritual friendship, what I call vertical spiritual friendship, between the less and the more spiritually experienced, especially between pupil and teacher, and horizontal spiritual friendship, the spiritual friendship that springs up within the Sangha among those who are practically on the same level. And we really need both. We can't always be in personal contact with our teacher, if we have one. Perhaps he or she has many disciples and doesn't have much time to spare for us. But in any case, we just need friendship, human friendship, and this we get from our peers. We all need this warmth in our spiritual lives. And then, corresponding to the light that the seed needs if it is to grow, we need intellectual clarity, clear thinking. Not all Western Buddhist teachers, it has to be said, are celebrated particularly for the clarity of thought. Only too often one comes across serious misunderstandings and misrepresentations, even about quite basic Dharma matters. Hence we need the light of intellectual clarity. We need clear thinking. And then, of course, more than anything, we need the rain of the Dharma. And the rain of the Dharma must be pollution-free. It must not be an acid rain. In other words, the Dharma must not be mixed with non-Dharmic or even anti-Dharmic elements. Buddhist teachers in both East and West are becoming increasingly aware of this danger. Yes, we need to engage in creative dialogue with the adherents of other religions and philosophies, but we need to be very clear about what the Buddha taught, what Buddhism teaches. We need the rain of the Dharma, desperately, more than ever before. But that rain needs to be pure, unmixed with Catholicism or Vedanta or secular ideologies. We need to saturate ourselves in the rain of the pure Dharma. In that way, our spiritual faculties will grow and develop and bear fruit, the precious fruit of enlightenment.